Many thinkers about the church colleges have seen the colleges as a place of engagement with society and culture. It's a place in which the church deliberately goes into a sort of enemy territory of the academic world in order to be in dialogue with the culture and with the society. And I reflect just for a few minutes, I don't like to read things to you, but there are just a couple of things that I think are really worth reading. One of my great influences on my life and on Maida's was a man named Joseph Sittler, who taught for many years at the University of Chicago, later at the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago. Maida and I first got to know him when we were students at Northwestern, and used to come up and talk to our Lutheran student group. And I have to stop and tell you a Joe Sittler story. Joe and we were quite close toward the end of his life, and he had been at St. Olaf and knew St. Olaf, and I consulted him when I was offered the position at St. Olaf, and so we had a lot of interesting conversations about what it would be like to be in the middle of that kind of Scandinavian Minnesota Lutheran culture. And on the, I am the first non-Norwegian lay president of St. Olaf in 114 years. For 114 years, they had ordained Norwegian presidents. And then they picked a German, Scots, Irish lay person for president. And on the day I was inaugurated, one of Joe's former students, who was on the faculty at St. Olaf, came up to me. She was just in hysterics because Joe had sent me a telegram. He'd sent it to her, but she was supposed to read it to me, and she did on the day of my inauguration, and it said this: 3.5 billion non-Norwegian lay people salute you in astonishment. And it was the single greatest inaugural message I got the whole week. It was typical Sittler. But Joe Sittler has written a couple of very interesting things about church colleges, and I just read you very brief excerpts. Joe is very much in the second camp. He saw, I have to use the past tense, probably still sees. He's probably still talking. He's up there talking to God about the church colleges right now as a place of engagement with culture. And he says this: now to the point, the church is engaged in the task of education because it is dedicated to the truth. For him, that was enough. That dedication alone is true to its nature and function. If my commitment to the faith is not one with my commitment to the truth, if those are two different things, no multiplication of secondary consolations or benefits will suffice to sustain that commitment for my own integrity. A person of integrity has to have commitment to the faith, and truth be the same thing. You can't live if your faith is over here and you think the truth is over here. You just can't do that. You can't put those together if you feel you have to choose between faith and truth. He went on in another little article about the church and liberal education, and this has been widely quoted. He said, the church has an absolutely clear and never-ending concern that generation after generation shall be made wise about the realities of human life. The church has no stake in babysitting innocence. A friend of mine who now teaches philosophy once said, quote, the purpose of a Christian college is to annihilate innocence. And he goes on to explain that in language which I won't bother to read. He says, unless you really understand the depth of human depravity, unless you really understand the agonies of human history, the conflicts of human life, the despair of human society. How can you know the grace of God? So it's not that we should protect people from unpleasant things. We have a duty as Christians to help them see the rottenness and the depths to which human nature has gone. Well, Martin Marty, whom all of you know, and whom I understand is coming next summer, to Holden, and who is a member of the St. Olaf Board of Regents, and a wonderful person who's thought deeply about the church colleges. And Martin Marty has put it this way, and this is an interesting sort of litany of definition about church colleges. As Luther, he's talking particularly about Lutheran colleges. Martin Marty would say, no, Baptist colleges may have a different thing. We can only talk about what Lutheran colleges are because Lutherans have a particular understanding of this. And I remind all of you that, after all, we're Lutherans because a university professor decided that people should think for themselves. I mean, that's why we're Lutherans. We started in a university. And Martin Marty says this, the mission of the ELCA colleges and universities is to respond to the promise of God, by risking, listen to that word, risking the confession of faith in order to participate in the conversation of culture. This is a long sentence. St. Paul could have written this sentence. To help the participants fulfill their vocations and thus be of service to God and others. So his vision of the church college, of the ELCA colleges, Lutheran colleges, is that we risk the confession of faith by engaging in a conversation with the culture in order that those who participate in that conversation may vocationally be led in service to God and society. And so he is also the second camp. This is a place in which we're going to have battles because the faith is going to be in dialogue with the culture and the society, and that's going to be difficult. There are other ways in which people have thought about the church colleges. A couple of us have tried to write about the church colleges following the articles of the Creed, and I'm not going to go into this, but if you think about the Apostles' Creed for a minute, and confessing God as creator and redeemer and sanctifier, one can make a sort of nice paradigm of the colleges. First of all, that confessing God as creator, we acknowledge that God has created everything, and in particular, has created our minds. And so, thinking, observing, even being a scientist, cannot be a bad thing. God made that. Bishop Ding of China spoke at St. Olaf a couple years ago, and pointed out for the first time to me, probably some of you have thought about this before, that when Jesus in the New Testament said the commandment is you should love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind, he was quoting from Deuteronomy, but in Deuteronomy the word mind does not appear. It's just with all your heart and with all your soul. And Jesus added, and with all your mind. So that Bishop Ding said, Jesus gave his blessing to the intellectual life, the academic life, thinking, learning, about all sorts of knowledge, mathematics, Shakespeare, English, sociology, whatever. So to acknowledge God as creator is to say our minds, all human knowledge, comes ultimately from God, lives under the umbrella of God, is part of God's reign, and hence must be a good thing. Second article says, God redeemed us through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. For colleges, that means, first of all, that that every person we see in the college is someone who has been redeemed and hence loved, is a person of worth and dignity, a human being. We are redeemed as whole people. We have a resurrection of the body even, and so we've got to be interested in the whole person as church colleges. That's got to be something the church college does. It's got to be as interested in the social and the spiritual and the physical as well as the mental. We can't see people as disembodied minds. And third, the Holy Spirit, God as Holy Spirit, calls us. There's that word vocation. We are called to a purpose. So a church college education must have a purpose in mind of service to the Lord. We are called by the Holy Spirit into community. The Holy Spirit gathers us together. And so a church college has to be a community in which people reinforce each other and support each other and love each other. So one can make a kind of a nice paradigm for the church colleges based on the creed. Okay, well, those are all various ways in which people have tried to think about the church colleges and why a church might have colleges. I want to get back now to the point of interdependence that I started with and have you help me think, if indeed the church and the colleges either are or should be in some ideal world interdependent, that means that each depends on the other. So that must mean that the colleges must depend on the church. And it must also mean that the church depends on the colleges. And now I ask you to suggest ways, things I might put under each one of these categories. What are some ways in which the colleges either do or should depend on the church? What are some ways in which the church either does or should depend on the colleges? What are some things we can fill in the blanks with?
Recruit students?
I'm sorry?
Recruit students.
Where would I put that?
The first one. Colleges depend on church.
To send us students,
mm-hmm.
We ought to be able, if we're ELCA colleges, to look to the congregations of the ELCA to at least encourage students to think about coming. I agree. That's a good thing to put in.
Financial support.
Where should I put that?
First one. I guess that's the only question.
We'll talk about that in just a minute. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Financial support. Okay.
On the bottom, it would be church depends on colleges for trained people. Train as leaders.
Right. Someone brought that up yesterday. The importance of lay leadership in our churches coming out of church colleges. And I mentioned that any number of pastors have said, if I look at my congregation and look at who are the real leaders, they tend, not exclusively, of course, but tend to be people who came out of church colleges.
Mm-hmm. I think that church depends on the college for critical thinking about the status quo.
Oh, give that man.
I've given out one award already this week. You get another one. I'm sorry.
Critical thinking about the status quo. Let's talk about that a little bit. I'm just absolutely, it's an act of God's grace that just came out of the group. I thought I'd have to. Why would the church depend on colleges for this?
Church tends to be more staid, and I think colleges tend to be more open in their thought processes, more liberal, more
free to involve more conflict in the college study.
Oh, this is wonderful. Where did you get this group from? I'm going to put that as a little bit separate item because I think that's a very important point. I want to come back, I don't want to lose this one, but I want to put this one down as a little bit separate point. Could I put it, Ken, this way, that the colleges provide a forum in which conflict is safe, or at least not.
Okay.
As we talked, when we were talking about political correctness, and it doesn't always work, but that's the idea. We had a wonderful conversation. Maine and I were talking with a couple the other night. I guess it was after the teaching staff forum, about how impossible it is in most congregations to have discussions of issues like abortion or homosexuality because people are afraid of those discussions. And if you try to have them, they tend to get emotional and finger-pointing, and people go away mad, and there tends to be a view of, well, this position isn't Christian, and this position is Christian, and so a college ought to be able, welcome. Is this the boat that just came?
We're rehearsing for the
talent show.
You're the talent show?
We are the talent show.
You are the talent show. Shall I stop now? You're going to perform? Well, we're glad to have you. Did you have to sit in the front with that tie on?
Yes.
So, indeed, a college ought to be able to provide a place in which difficult issues can be discussed civilly and without choosing up sides as to who's a Christian and who's not a Christian.
Ask a question along those lines. How safe is that idea? The Baptist has found it's not real safe. Do you get much feedback in the other Lutheran communities?
I think the Lutherans do this as well as is consistent with my understanding of the deeply sinful nature of human beings. I give you one example, and I can only give you a sample example because I've never lived, worked, or studied on another ELC college campus, but I think this would not be untypical. Mark, you may be an example. The day after the Gulf War broke out, a lot of students came to me and said, we need to talk about this. So I put up signs all over campus that said from 4:30 to 6, in our equivalent of the Koinonia, the fireside room, I would be available along with a couple of faculty members whose special area was the Middle East for people who wanted to talk. I don't know if you were there, Bob, but we had maybe 400 students come in and out. And I made a very brief opening statement simply to say that this was a place in which I hoped any opinions, any concerns, any questions could be raised. And students came in and the first 5 or 10 voices were, isn't this awful that we've gone to war, it's terrible, we shouldn't have done it, it's not right. And I think it was a man with his hand up sort of tentatively, and I motioned to encourage him. He said, I'm not sure this will be popular for me to say, but I think it's okay that we went to war. I think we had to do that for the following reasons. And he talked about the terrible things that were going on in Kuwait and who else would stop them if we didn't. And somebody else said, well, I don't agree with you, but I'm interested to hear your viewpoint. And then they got into a discussion of no matter how you felt about it, let's not treat when the soldiers came home, let's not treat them the way we treated the people who came back from Vietnam, as if this war were all their fault, and dump on them all of our anger about the war. And it was a wonderful conversation in which people were able, with different opinions. I mean, some were going up to Minneapolis to protest the war, and others were going up to Minneapolis to fly the flag, and they were able pretty well to fly future. So I give you that example as one illustration that it does at least sometimes work. And I think sometimes works pretty well. I'm going to leave this for just a minute because we're going to come back to that. Very good point. What else could I put up here? Ways in which, we're talking about the ways in which, this is interdependent studies, we're talking about the way the church and its colleges ought to be interdependent.
Advice on pre-sem training needs?
Where would I put that?
Right on the top.
Up here. The colleges would get advice from the church.
Yeah.
Right. I have the worst handwriting in the world, so part of the test at the end of this course is to read what I wrote. This is an interesting point. Remembering, for example, we talked about yesterday that Gettysburg College was actually founded by Schmucker, who founded Gettysburg Seminary and then learned that none of the people that were coming to Gettysburg Seminary were prepared for seminary training. So he founded the college to sort of correct the deficiencies in seminary training. And so historically there's been a close connection between the seminaries and the church colleges, less now because so many seminarians are not coming out of the church colleges. They're second career people who are coming out of other kinds of institutions. But this is an important thing. Indeed, the church should be advising us about pre-seminary training and its needs. Yes?
What about the church's position papers on social issues? Do the colleges depend on the church for those position papers and do anything with those position papers?
We do not. Maybe we should. Actually, we could put that on either place. Does the church ever go to the colleges for help in writing the position papers? And the answer is almost never.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. Maybe we just ought to put out on the side here, because it sort of relates to both, position papers on issues. The colleges probably ought to use them, and the church probably ought to depend on the colleges to help produce them. I saw a hand, but yes.
No, I was wondering if ever the ideas that come out of the colleges, the critical thinking about the status quo that were run by the church, to see if they're going off the deep end and are totally out of touch with the person in the pew.
We will get back to that too in just a minute, okay? We'll get back to that in just a minute. It's a good point. Other ways in which the church and the colleges, one or the other depends on the other. Colleges depending on the church for students, financial support, advice about pre-seminary training needs. I guess that I'd have to say that I think probably the very most important thing that ought to go up here hasn't yet appeared. So I'm encouraging you to think about that. Bob?
Well, one could say both ways, prayer.
Uh-huh. One could say it both ways, and one should say it both ways. Yes?
Examples of faith in action?
Where are you thinking
that
about?
Maybe that the college depends on the church, that the church faithfully at work is
provides,
The college's temptation is to study the truth and to be content with that. And the church needs to model doing the truth.
Okay. I think this is getting close to what I'm missing up here. Yes?
About foundations and faith, where the college depends upon the church to provide with a foundation and faith.
Can you expound on that? Are you saying foundation and two different words?
Well, foundation in faith, so that the students can go through college and learn in a Christian atmosphere rather than in a totally secular atmosphere.
Yeah, I think now with these two comments, we're very close to what I had in mind, and I'm going to put it, if I may, this way. The colleges depend on the church for their mission. That, and I think that's the most important way in which we depend on the church to give us a mission. In the little town where Maida and I live, Northfield, Minnesota, there are two colleges. There's St. Olaf and Carleton. St. Olaf sits high on a hill, and then we like to say we look down on Carleton. Carleton says St. Olaf is the college that was built on a bluff and is run the same way. So we have a lot of friendly rivalry. But, you know, they're both very fine institutions. We have a better mathematics department than Carleton does. Carleton has a better geology department than we do. They're very fine institutions. The difference is right here. Mm-hmm. We have a mission which derives from the church. Carleton no longer does. He did at one point, like Carver did, but it does not. And I simply cannot stress enough, there's probably no reason to have in Northfield a St. Olaf if it looked exactly like Carleton. Mm-hmm. I mean, there wouldn't be, why would there be a reason for that? There's no reason to have an Augsburg in Minneapolis, you know, if it looks exactly like McAllister. And if we lose that, friends, as far as I'm concerned, maybe we'll close up. There's just simply no reason to operate institutions that don't have a kingdom submission. Okay, anything else anybody can think of that we're missing here? Okay. Well, now I think what I want to do is to leave, I think I'm going to leave the bottom on and erase this. I want to move now to something that is very much on my mind talk to you about something that is now happening in the ELCA. Again, I apologize to those of you who may not be ELCA people. But if you are ELCA and read the Lutheran and are aware of what's going on, some of you maybe know that Bishop Chilstrom has proposed, as of the end of April, to the Church Council and the bishops that all the funding for all the ELCA colleges be ended. And he has done that because of the financial problems of the ELCA. And he issued a long position paper, which has been fairly widely circulated now, and which was summarized in a little article in the Lutheran, saying essentially this: ever since the merger, we've been struggling with the finances of the ELCA, and that's true. And we have hoped this would go away. We have made some reductions, we have cut some staff, we've tried to reduce expenditures. People have said, well, we're in a recessionary time and things will get better. And he has said, and I think correctly, things are not going to get better. Things are only going to get worse for the ELCA. And so we've got to make some major surgery. And as you remember, if you were here yesterday, the church in total is sending to its church colleges about $5 million a year. And that sounds like a lot of money, except I remind you that the percentage of the college budgets, that is, and there are a number of new people here, so I've got to get this word in because people are surprised at this. Remember yesterday when I asked what percent of college budgets is supplied by the ELCA, and people guessed as high as 30%, and in fact it is 0.7% is what's coming from the church. 0.7%. People are usually astonished at that. But that's $5 million. So, I mean, in one way, it's a lot of money. In another way, it's a minuscule drop in the budget. For St. Olaf, it's less than 0.5% of our budget. But he has proposed cutting out all of that. And you remember that was a mixture of synodical and church-wide money. It's about half and half. So the church-wide money is about $2.5 million, and about $2.5 million comes from the synods, directly earmarked for the colleges. But he has said we'll save $2.5 million if we simply cut out all the grants from church-wide to the colleges internally. Some of us are very upset about that. And we're upset about that not so much for the money. I truly believe that if I stopped going to meetings at Higgins Road, I could raise the $250,000 that St. Olaf gets from the church in less time than it takes me to go to the meetings on Higgins Road that I go to. I really believe if I went to alumni and corporations and people in the Twin Cities, I could replace that money in less time than I'm spending in churchly organizational matters. So it's not, if it were the money, I'd say, take the money and go. I have muttered in my nastier moments that if in fact the church does cut out all the funding for the colleges, what I would do instead of going to these church meetings would be to go to the large congregations in Minnesota and say, let me tell you something. Instead of sending your benevolent, why don't you earmark $500 scholarships for any member of your congregation who wants to go to any ELCA college? And I tell you, I think the colleges would get a lot more money. I don't plan to do that yet, but I'm trying to impress on you that my emotion about this is not about $250,000. I can find $250,000. My emotion about this goes to the word that I raised, mission. I think that if the ELCA ends its grants to its colleges, St. Olaf will not be different 10 years from now. Luther will not be different 15 years from now. But 100 years from now, I think there'll be different places. I think the pressures of secularization, the pressures of accommodating to a wider and wider variety of points of view will simply overwhelm any residual feelings of interdependence with the church. They may last 25 years, they may last 50 years, but I would doubt they would last 100 years. And when that's gone, I think the whole reason for being. Now, I want to get back to this point about critical thinking about the status quo, because several of us are meeting with Bishop Chilstrom and members of the Church Council in Chicago on July 27, and I actually came to Holden to rest up for this encounter tomorrow night. Because what we have decided to do is to say to the bishop and the officials who are there, that we agree that this problem of the church is not going to go away. We agree that the financial problem is serious and some radical steps have to be taken. But we think that the proposal is one that is dealing with the symptom of the problem and not the problem itself. And that we believe in our position of being able maybe to look a little bit from the outside about the status quo, we believe that in fact the financial problem the ELCA may be deriving from two causes. One of which is that the programmatic agenda of the ELCA is too broad and too out of touch with the people in the pews. Somebody mentioned people in the pews over here. Many of us think the ELCA is trying to do too many things, take on too many issues. I don't know what you happen to think about merger with the Episcopalians, but most of the people I talked to in Minnesota thought that was not a burning issue to waste a lot of time. and most people that I talk to are not really excited about whether our pastors had the laying on of hands from somebody in the apostolic succession or not. There's just not a lot of concern about that in the people I talk to. I don't know about the rest of you, but And I'm not making fun of it. I mean, that's a legitimate thing to think about, I suppose, but it's just not high on my priority list. I like my pastor fine, and I don't care who laid hands on him. I think God speaks through him, and so just leave him alone. He didn't have to go up to Sweden to be ordained by someone in the Swedish Apostolic Succession, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, that's an example of at least the conversations that I'm part of, people thought was kind of a silly, unnecessarily divisive issue for the church to get involved with. And the second thing is that the church's organizational structure, we think, is Byzantine, overly complex, totally disconnected from the congregations. I don't know whether you're aware of it, but the church council of the ELCA, the governing board, if you like, of the ELCA, is not composed of representatives of synods. It's elected independently. So, I mean, it has no connection with the synods, and hence really none with the congregations. So we've got this Byzantine structure with 65 synods and 65 bishops and regions and regional structures, and then this church council, which isn't connected with any of that, that actually makes the decision, and the bishop and all these commissions that fly into Chicago and fly out again, and I think no one understands all that, and it doesn't seem connected with word and sacrament and mission in the local community. And I guess I think that's a function of church colleges. And I'm kind of proud of my fellow presidents that at least the plan is to go on July 27 and kind of, in a loving way, because we're all concerned about the church and its future, say, we agree there's a problem, but let's not try to cure the symptom. Let's say to ourselves, maybe the way we put this camel together wasn't quite the right way. It's nobody's fault. It's not the CNLC's fault. Those people did the best job they could. We've got a church. We want a church. We don't want to be just a group of 20,000 individual congregations. Let's fix it. Let's make it work right, lest we go the way of the dinosaurs, which is, I think, what's happening to the mainline Protestant denomination. I think we've got a chance to save this. And I think in a very funny way, it may be exactly Bishop Chilstrom's statement about doing away with the funding of the church colleges that might trigger this. I spent the last week before I came to Holdings on the phone with bishops and seminary people, and every person I talked to about this says, absolutely, right on, let's do it. And so I have some encouragement about this. So I guess I really find that's why I reacted so favorably to your two points about, and don't we have a, and I think you said, shouldn't the churches go back to the college and run some of these ideas by them? So read the newspaper on July 28th and see if we all got burned at the stake. But I want to move on from this. I want to save some time for discussion because it would be very interesting, your reactions and suggestions. But I've been thinking then a lot about the way the church depends on the colleges. And I guess I have some things that I'd like to add to this. I think the church depends on the colleges in a way that none of us has ever appreciated, for proclaiming the gospel to the unchurched. Now, the colleges are not primarily in the business of converting souls to Christianity. I think that's not our primary business. But it occurs to me as I look at St. Olaf campus, they're a lot more not very churched people there who get exposed, at least, to the Word of God, than there are in any congregation of the ELCA. Through chapel, a professor, a speaker, the music, Everybody goes to the Christmas festival at St. Olaf. It is entirely a proclamation of the incarnation of God in Jesus Christ. So that at least in some small way, the church ought to look at the colleges as a place in which the proclaiming of the word is actually occurring. Imperfectly, sure. Not as organized as in the congregation, but at least there's some interesting people there. I remember once some of our students made a videotape from the student point of view about St. Olaf to show to alums, and I remember very well, I was amazed that the administration had nothing to do with this. We had no role in writing the script, doing the videotape, anything. And we took that and showed it to our alums. Now that's trusting your students. And I remember vividly, one of the very first aspects of St. Olaf they talked about was the life of the student congregation and chapel. And this one woman overlaid her voice, overlaying a service, a scene of a service in Bow Chapel, said, "I didn't come to St. Olaf to become a better Christian. That's not why I came here." She said, "But it happened." And I really, of course, I just stood up and applauded. I thought that was terrific. But it does, it happens. And, yes, ma'am.
And I don't think you can underestimate the effect of one student talking to another. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talk to many students who have become Christians because of a friend, a fellow student, who has witnessed to it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The church also ought to depend on the colleges for, I'm going to use a funny word here, I don't like this very much, but access to communities of color. Yeah. The church colleges are much more diverse than is the church. Much more diverse than is the church. I don't know whether any of you were delegates to the ELCA Churchwide Assembly, not the Orlando one, but the one before that, at which all the Namibian students who had come to the ELCA colleges to be trained came and danced and sang through the assembly. I mean, what a wonderful symbol. And the church colleges did that. You know, we provided room, board, and tuition for all those students free of charge. I mean, that was a ministry to the church global to do that. The church ought also to look on the colleges, I think, and this is a word that I think I'm going to use a lot this coming year, as communities of hope. Martin Marty, in some of his writing about the church colleges that I quoted from briefly before, says that even if you think about salvation with a small s, the church has colleges because only through education can one make the world a better place, can one provide salvation with a small s. He's not talking about God's redemption, but about making the world a better place and fixing the things that are broken that happen. But I was so struck by this possibility for the colleges by an event that happened this spring. As many of you know, the thing St. Olaf is mostly known for is the Golden Girl. Now, you remember Betty White's character is from the town of St. Olaf. And in fact, when they first started that series, they wrote to us and asked, would we mind if they called this town St. Olaf? And we said no. And so we've had a kind of close relationship with the show. We've sent them St. Olaf t-shirts. And when our choir was in Los Angeles, we all went to a taping of the Golden Girls. And Betty White and some of the cast came out of intermission and sang Ya Ya. They had learned our fight song and sang it to the choir. And the choir sang Happy Birthday to Betty because it had been her birthday that week. And but she had never been to St. Olaf. But she kind of got really intrigued with the college through her association with some of our staff and students. And so she contacted us several months ago, and she said, "I would like to come as a private citizen. I'm going to pay my own way. I don't want to make speeches or anything. I just want to come and spend the day at St. Olaf." So they were scheduled to come, arrive on Sunday afternoon, I think it was May the 4th. And it turned out that was the Sunday after the Los Angeles riots started. On, I think it was a Tuesday, I think it was the previous Tuesday was the day the riot started. And she was coming with her private secretary and associate, and they were flying on Sunday morning. And we weren't even sure they were going to make it, because then they canceled so many flights because of the smoke, and then there were people, I guess, shooting rifles at airplanes as they took off. And so, but they did make it. And they had a funny experience on the plane. There was a steward who was very solicitous about Betty and wanted to be sure everything was all right. And he said, "Now, are you changing planes at Minneapolis?" And she said, "No, we're coming to visit Minnesota." And he said, "Well," he kidded her, he said, "as long as you're in Minnesota, you probably ought to go down and see St. Olaf." And she said, "Well, actually, that's the only reason we're coming." And of course, he said he was sort of amazed at that. The plane landed, pulled up to the gate at the Minneapolis airport, and he came back and he said, "Miss White," he said, "I'm a little worried about the logistics. How are you getting to St. Olaf?" It was Sunday afternoon. And she said, "Well, someone from the college is meeting me." And the steward said, "Well, that's good." He said, "Because, you know, there's only one road into and out of St. Olaf, and it's closed on Sundays." And she said, for just a minute, she thought, "Oh my goodness, I've got this all fouled up." And then he just collapsed in the aisle laughing. So she But they came and they spent 24 hours. She went to a woman's softball game. She talked in a class, a speech theater class, about life in the theater and films. She came to chapel, in which I talked about Rose Nyland's innocence in a Christian way. She had lunch with student leaders, and she had a wonderful time. And there were tears rolling down her eyes several occasions, and her secretary, Gail, came up in particular and took my hand and said, "You will never know what this meant to us." She said, "This week, in the middle of those riots in Los Angeles, and the hatred, and the killing, and the destruction," and she said, "I had decided there was no hope for a world in which my grandson could grow up." And she said, "Coming here and meeting these young people, and seeing the way faculty and staff care for them and they care for each other," she said, "you have given us hope." And I was just really moved by that. And as I've thought about our church colleges, they are places in which hope can live and perhaps be visible. If you haven't been on a church college, the ELC college campus recently, I encourage you just to walk onto one, almost anyone, and sit down and talk with two or three students, and you will go away with hope. And maybe that, in fact, is the best gift that we can give to the church and through the church to the world. Well, I'm sorry, I get off my soapbox. Comments, questions? Reactions, John.
Well, I think I'd like to say, take heart. The social ministry institutions preceded you in being cut out of church budgets. The one I come from is down to 0.1%. But it's not as bad at all. I think what we need more than their money, and you sort of said this yourself, is to raise high the flag of our relationship to the church. And this was the proposition I made to our synod. I said, "Okay, just give me a token. I'll accept that. But put us high on the flag of your ministry, the church's ministry. Give us the publicity." I said, "I just want that." And it's been a wonderful trade. So I don't think you should be overly concerned about losing the money.
But you see, you still got a token. I don't care if they cut this to 0.1%.
Well, they should have a token.
There must be a connection. Without a connection, there's no memory. I think in the long run, in the long run. I agree with you 100%. I don't care if the bishop would say, we're going to give you $1,000 a year and that's all. Fine, it's a line item in the church's budget. It forces the church to vote.
But there are a lot of other ways to get that.
Yes?
Do you know if there's a historical precedent for the cutting of ties as the first step in the process, say, with the Methodists and the Presbyterians and all of the ways that those ties have been cut?
I don't know the history well enough to know what things went first in those. But in all of those cases, there is no more money, and there is no more connection, virtually. And so, but I can't say that was cause and effect. It just seems to me that it's dangerous. It seems to me it's a danger if the tie is cut entirely, the financial tie is cut entirely. Anyway.
I do recall reading an article some years ago about earlier in the century, when the federal government was offering funds to institutions for teacher training. And there were some church colleges at the time who really struggled because they wanted the funds that would help their budgets and that would enable them to train more teachers. But if they accepted those federal funds, they couldn't receive them if they were still church colleges, and so they cut their ties to receive those federal funds. And they were, you know, I remember, I think, specifically reading some examples of Methodist and Presbyterian.
Of course, Hartwick ended its ties with the church, as we saw. And the president, I don't know the president of Hartwick, he's not part of any of the church discussion. I do want to be clear that you understand, as I try to stress, my concern is not the $250,000, it's that the church view us as a part of their dependency sphere. That's what really concerns me. Yes?
I'd just like to reinforce what you're saying there. I heard it said once that there's an inherent conflict or a tension in the church college setting, and that it should be there because it's the church's role to profess the truth, and it's the college's role to discover the truth. And in the midst of that relationship and that kind of dual identity, there has to be a tension. And if we lose our identity with the church, we lose the creative tension that makes the church college a different place.
There does have to be that tension. I couldn't agree more. Closing comment, because we need to go. At one point when we were talking about the financial support, I was kidding about did I put it down here or up there, and we finally put it up here, that the colleges ought to be able to depend on the church for financial support. But an interesting and kind of amusing thing, in Bishop Chilstrom's letter, he made the analogy that in a family, when the children are young, the parents support the children, and that's a part of their close relationship. But he said when the children grow up, as the colleges have now, then there should be no financial tie, but the relationship should still exist. And of course, I immediately thought, yes, but then there's a third stage. In which the parents become senile and the children take care of them. I hope the tape had run out by then.